Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hey everybody, Chad Wesley Smith here, bringing you another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I'm joined today by Microchip Max Montana. How you doing, buddy?
Pretty good. I feel like Shorty should put some kind of like cool cyborg looking effects on my face. mostly to cover my face, but also to make it cool.
Yeah,
Terminator-esque.
If you could turn the right side of Max's face into like a Terminator metal face, that would probably be good for everyone involved, Max and viewers alike.
You'll have to edit that out though, so it just appears that way. Don't let them know we talked about it beforehand.
Today's episode is brought to you by Milligrams and Kilograms. The more you take, the more you make. Milligrams and Kilograms t-shirts and coffee mugs available at store.jtsstrength.com. And today we're going to be talking to you about the top five strength stories of 2017. And this also is not the one-year anniversary of the Jug Life podcast, but probably about the one-year anniversary of taking it seriously and doing a good job at it. I think it was this episode last year where we started doing video basically every week and where we started actually releasing episodes every week. So happy anniversary to us and wonderful job of not screwing it up for the last year. Some of the things that we'll be talking about today actually were part of our end of the year predictions in our 2016 episode. I have to say we were pretty dead on in a lot of those things, including predicting that the U.S. would win multiple international medals, which just happened a few weeks ago at the World Weightlifting Championships, where I think of total medals, the women won two and the men won another one. And then there was a lot of individual lift medals along the way as well. We predicted a continued crackdown and changes to the structure of the sport of weightlifting. We'll talk more about that. And we predicted the first 500 kilo raw squat, and that happened, and it happened a few times, in fact. So we'll get into all of those things. To lead things off, and this certainly in a lot of ways is a continuation of 2016, but I think was even more notable, is just the rising trend of incredible female strength athletes and incredible accomplishments being made by them. To start off close to home with that one, Marissa Inda won her first IPF World Championship in June in Belarus, but before that, at the very first IPF Arnold Grand Prix, which showcased four of the top raw women, four top raw men, and four for each gender and single ply as well. Marissa set the world record in the 52 kilo class across all federations. That's since been broken for non-IPF competition, but she still has the world record for the IPF. Made a 5:32 Wilks at that. Just incredible lifting. Elsewhere in powerlifting, the U.S. Open, so shortly after Marissa's performance at the Arnold, the U.S. Open showcased some just insane female powerlifting. Mariana Gaspiara, I think, made like a 6:11 Wilks or something like that, maybe even higher. Squatted like 230 in reps at 60 kilos body weight, so over 500-pound squat for 132-pound female lifter. Christy Hawkins made some incredible lifts this year. Kim Walford always doing Kim Walford things, pulling huge deadlifts, winning IPF World Championships. Jen Thompson, even though she had some time off this year because of injuries, I still need to ask her if she was just, if she was kind of just playing with everyone leading up to nationals, because I was like, there's no way she's coming back, and then she comes back with a lifetime PR in the squat, and a lifetime total PR, and of course with that a new world record in the incredibly competitive 63 kilo class. So quick shout out there to runner up in that class, Samantha Calhoun, and then Team Juggernaut athlete and coach Kristen Dunsmore. Kristen made a 5:10 Wilkes at Nationals and only took third in the 63 kilo class. So I think that's a real testament to how the just incredibly rapid rate that female powerlifting has improved. There was actually four women in that class with over a 500 Wilkes and four women who all exceeded the gold medal total from IPF World Championships.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And then I think in a lot of ways, sort of the maybe top women's powerlifting star of the year was Steffi Cohen. Yeah, you know, just really pushing that deadlift up to remarkable levels. 500 for 500 for reps in training, over 500 in... Did she do over 500 in competition?
I think she pulled 225, so 495.
Yeah, but just insane lifts and, you know, of course, the sport of powerlifting, you got to do it when it counts, but still making amazing lifts and I think really pushing the boundaries of what people thought was possible, you know, for a 125 pound girl to be deadlifting 500 for five, you know, any of the other stuff people want to bring up about it, straps, bumpers, deadlift bar, whatever. It's a 125 pound girl deadlifting 500 pounds for reps. And so, you know, great job to her and incredible, you know, it'll be interesting to see how long this type of progress can be sustained for women's powerlifting as a whole. I mean, it'll have to slow down at some point, but is that point in 2018? Is it in 2019, 2020? Who knows? Cause, you know, even looking specifically at Marissa's weight class, the 52 kilo class in the IPF, at the 2016 Arnold, Marissa deadlifted 385 for the world record. There's at least five women in that weight class now who can do over that number. So
that's crazy.
Yeah. And that's, you know, a year and a half of lifting. So pretty remarkable there. On the weightlifting side of things, American women's weightlifting, you know, just had their greatest performance ever. 2017 Weightlifting World Championships, they took second as a team, second to only Thailand, had the first world champion in how long, Max?
I believe 97. So it's 1997.
In 20 years, Sarah Robles, by winning the 90-plus kilo category, sweeping the 90-plus kilo category, became the first U.S. athlete to win worlds in 20 years. Maddie Rogers added a bronze medal to that. And, you know, of course, there's a lot of people who are going to look back and on these worlds and say, oh, that's only happening because of doping bans and the like. And we talked about this a bit more in our world recap video. But if you were to look at the 2 years... You know, because traditionally the year after the Olympics is a bit of a down year for weightlifting world championships. Why that happens, you know, is open to interpretation, but it's not too far off of really these countries that were banned weren't that present in the year after the Olympics anyways because of basically the reasons that they're banned now. They were taking time away from international, aka tested competition anyways. So if we were to look back at 2013 Worlds, if the U.S. team went and made the same totals that they did at 2017 Worlds, we actually would have had even a better performance, which would have included two first places. Sarah Robles would have won by 40 kilos at 2013 Worlds with the total she made here. Jenny would have won, Alyssa would have been second, Maddie would have been third still, and Caitlin would have been fourth. So, you know, just the level of strength sports for women in America is skyrocketing. Women around the world in powerlifting, but specifically U.S. women's weightlifting. So special congratulations in that to our Team Juggernaut athletes, Alyssa Ritchie, who just took seventh at Worlds, and then at the American Open, Kiana Welch, Chucky Welch, you may know her as, broke the American record in the snatch with 108 kilos, which was previously held by Olympian Jenny Arthur, and that's a pretty special feat for Q. So Coach Max, you may have seen Max, you know, fangirling like he was 13 years old at an NSYNC concert at the side of the platform in the videos there. But how was that moment for you, Coach?
That was awesome. That was one of those moments where you're just super happy. And, it certainly isn't the first time I've coached someone to break a record or break an American record. But, with Q, it was a little more of a sweet victory because, Q's gone through a lot of stuff and she's new. And there was a lot of like kind of uncertainty going into it because of the state that she was in from training. She had some shoulder stuff, but to have somebody really like, I feel like that lift just showcased her ability mentally as an athlete. It showcased a lot of stuff about her that I think is something you can't just pinpoint as being a training or as this or that. It was really just one person overcoming, her own situation and all that stuff to make a big lift. And that was what was exciting for me. Obviously, I have a vested interest in Q because she's my athlete, but it was just really cool for me to see that, I think.
Yeah.
And I appreciated it a lot.
We didn't quite use the strategy that I was going for, right?
We almost did.
Previously two strategies. You're thinking of my clean and jerk opening strategy, but previously in training, Q had towards the latter half of August, you may have seen her snatch 107 in training during a mini camp down here in Southern California. But prior to that, Q had been hospitalized from the bar crashing on her throat, lowering a jerk, and it like broke off some sort of cyst or polyp in there. And anyway, she was hospitalized for a while and had not snatched in 10 days, hadn't trained in like a week or 10 days, and maybe snatched the one day prior, and then comes the next day and snatches 107 in training to tie the American record. So as she had been struggling with some shoulder problems in the last 6 or so weeks leading up to the American Open, she hadn't done more than maybe 102 since then to win the CrossFit liftoff. Congratulations again there, Q. She won the snatch and the total portion of that and got to win herself some cash. And but I joked, I was like, well, just don't have her snatch. Well, and then she started doing this thing and the training snatches were like, are her hands moving? What's going on
so,
here?
Yeah, I mean, that was something. So she hurt her shoulder at the training camp. She didn't hurt it there. She hurt it a couple of weeks before that doing a pull-up at work. And she was snatching great. And then she missed one behind and it just set her shoulder off and it was hurting a lot. So we just stopped it there. That was the last time she snatched heavy until the week before the meet where she did the CrossFit liftoff. And she snatched like 100 or 90 a couple of weeks, like a week, like the beginning of the week.
And just to give, did 102
at the end
here.
Of the week for the liftoff.
Yeah, to give then a timeline, she missed 109 at camp and kind of aggravated the shoulder injury.
Yeah.
That was the first week of November. That was probably like November 5th. And then fast forward to the last week of November, she hadn't done more than 90 in between. Does 102?
Yeah, she only did. We only did snatch pulls until the week before. Basically the week before AO. Then she did a couple of heavy snatches and worked up to like 100. But everything was very rough. Nothing looked smooth. And then she tells me, "Hey, my left hand is moving in. Just her left hand. It's moving in when I turn it over." And I was like, that's really weird, and I was like, well, let's try and do some stuff to, focus on your arm and what you're doing and this and that. And then warming up for the competition, I said to her, I was like, look, it didn't happen at the lightweights at all. And I said to her, look, don't worry about your hand. What, you know, if it moves in, it moves in. You can't change it now. Just focus on what you have to do to be successful and to execute good technique with your lifts. And, you know, so little do we know, they both moved in on 108.
Yeah.
But what's funny to me is that if you look at her 100 and her 104 and compare that to almost every other snatch she's done in a competition, she looked great. You know, I mean, they were some of the best snatches she's done. Really, really nice technique. Everything was solid. You know, the 108, her hands moved in a little bit and it was just like a tiny bit forward. But she has such fantastic positioning and such great athleticism, you know, and she was just able to, I kept telling her, just expect to make it, right? Just expect to make it. And I think she actually, you know, definitely put that in her mind, right? Because when she turned it over, it was forward, but I think she was so ready to have caught it that, you know, she was able to actually succeed with it. So.
Yeah. That was a great moment. And it was like a reverse Gore Minasian move. And Q, in most ways, I'd say, is a reverse Gore Minasian.
The only thing I could imagine that they would be similar in is what they would order from the menu at a bar, pub, brewery. I'll have the appetizers and the entrees, please.
Yeah, that was a you know, a remarkable moment for her. So to just kind of wrap that part up, incredible performance by women across the world in powerlifting, you know, U.S. women's weightlifting continuing to rise up. I mean, even at the American Open, we're just seeing these women make lifts, people we hadn't even heard of, you know, that 125 kilo clean and jerk in the 69s.
Yeah.
For that youth lifter.
This 48.
Yeah. Haley Reichart in the 48s.
96.
Clean and jerking double body weight, 18 years old. So it's only going to continue to move forward and improve. So a great story for 2017, and I'm sure something we'll be talking about in 2018 a lot as well. Transitioning over to our next story, and these are in no particular order, but just the incredible super heavyweight performances in weightlifting. You know, highlighted far and away by one man, Lasha. I should really learn how to say his last name. We talk about him enough here that Lasha T.
It's a hard one.
So we'll just call him, you know, when you're this strong, you only need one name, Lasha. But even before him, and we talked about this in our world's recap, it was the best session, you know, far and away, the most exciting session, the most made lifts, the biggest lifts. Are some of these things going to go away with increased testing and all that? Maybe, but that's a discussion for another day. Just kind of want to celebrate the amazing performances that came with that. I mean, Lasha throughout the whole year, but, you know, Martin Seam had the great performance at Worlds, had, you know, all these huge, huge squats and training that we love watching. Ali Husseini returned to competition from a long layoff, you know, regardless of reasoning, a long layoff. Ali Husseini, Salimi, huge lifts, Fernando Reyes from Brazil, doing a lot of incredible stuff. But we talked about this in the other podcast a bit, but Max, can you kind of put in historical context what Lasha did at Worlds in both the snatch and the total?
I'm pretty sure, and I have to look it up, but I can't imagine anyone has opened at 210 kilos in the snatch before. And maybe Krostev did when he did 216. But let's say Lasha is one of maybe just a couple people to open at 210. how many people have actually snatched more than 210 is an even smaller group. And then how many people have made 215 is even smaller than that. But the 220 was just, I mean, that's astronomical. So no one's ever even, only one man has ever even called for that weight to be put on the bar before. And that was Krostev. And he didn't even take it. I'm pretty sure he didn't take it. But so Lasha is the only person ever to even do a 220 kilo snatch officially, even, you know, regardless of the time. On top of that, the clean and jerk, the 257 for a total record breaks the absolute highest total ever done. So 477 is the highest total any super has ever done. And that includes all the best, you know, Taranenko, Pisarenko, Krostev, you know, Krulovich, Tremurkin, everybody. That's the biggest total ever. So that's unbelievable.
Yeah,
and on top of all that, he's really young for a super.
Yeah, he's very young. He's very entertaining to watch because his lifts don't look like the super's lifts in a lot of ways. He's such a smooth mover. He's so tall. Yeah. And he's so calm in the face of adversity, you know, and adversity normally being irate Iranian fans.
Like
that was at the Olympics.
The Iranian fans deserve their own spot in the top five of, like, they are just assholes. I mean, there's no other way to put it. Like, and I get it, they're passionate, but I think the Iranian fans, the fact that they were going nuts about every lift and about all the, like, all the Iranians, like, it's kind of fun because they get into it, but then they take it too far and they start booing and kind of messing with other lifters. But that kind of adds to the drama, I thought. I mean, being there in person was really cool to see that.
Yeah. It to me, for sure, adds to Lasha's mystique. It's at the 2016 Olympics, kissing his bicep he chalked his hands and kind of looking at the Iranian fans like, you ready for what I'm about to do? To this, you know, just coming out and smashing lifts so casually, so routinely.
Yeah.
Because when we talk about the heaviest total ever, you know, this is in known competition. And most of these names that Max mentioned, you know, Taranenko, Pistorenko, all these people, were competing in a time when drug testing did not exist. You know, it didn't exist, or it was so rudimentary that, you know, 100% of people taking drugs were beating the tests. And is that to speculate that, oh my gosh, Lasha's clean because he's getting drug tests? Of course it's not to speculate that. But a time when it's an absolute free-for-all versus having to really work for it and you know, having to beat the test more strategically or whatever it is, they can't just take whatever they want. So to do it on the biggest, you know, on one of the biggest stages at World Championships, you know, not a local-ish kind of meet, or not a meet that was in his home country of Georgia or his home kind of region, but to fly halfway around the world, to do it against two other phenomenal lifters in Ali Husseini and Behdad Salimi, to do it while the Iranian fans are jeering him, was a really cool moment. Maybe it's something in a year or 2 years we're looking back at and being like, hey, remember when supers used to, when there was eight people who snatch over 200? There are eight snatches over 200.
Yeah.
You know, remember when that was happening all the time? Because maybe it won't be happening if the drug testing really cracks down and we just got to see the last fantastic moment of that. But there's just something special about the biggest weight classes. You know, it's if you don't go to the circus to see the mice, you got to see the elephants, and the elephants,
you know,
definitely delivered.
What's funny is that in maybe like 2000, they did like a 100 year, like the best of the century sports, And there was an interview with Hussein Rezazadeh, who held the current world record in the clean and jerk. And he said he wanted to be known for the next century as the first man to total 500 kilos. And he, you know, he set out as that was his thing, and he never actually got there. But he never really looked like he would be able to do a 500 total with that snatch. I mean, he snatched 212, but, you know, I mean, like, whereas you see Lasha, and it's conceivable the guy looks like he could total 500 kilos. I mean, if he was to snatch another 7 kilos or 10 kilos and clean and jerk, you know, another 15, none of his lifts look like they're not within that range, and he has another 10 years to do it. So, you know, if he did something on that scale, which is, you know, we're talking about the most insane numbers ever, but the idea that, like, you know, he could go down in history as, you know, maybe one of the strongest weightlifters ever, if that snatch improves and that clean and jerk improves, which it seems like it would, barring, you know, any more, you know, barring failing another drug test or whatever, but yeah, very, very incredible.
And this next one is one that we predicted in our 2016 episode, is that we would see the first 500 kilo raw squat, a raw with wraps squat ever. And I think that nobody in the world, maybe the guy who did it, would have predicted that he would have been the first. But yeah. I think he would have gotten about 99% of people saying that Andrei Milanichev would have been the first person to do 500 kilos in competition. You know, maybe Zahir would have voted for himself, but yeah. Everyone else would have been saying, yeah, Milanichev, 500 kilo squat, he'll do it in 2017. And we got a 500 kilo squat. In fact, we got two 500 kilo squats, and neither of them by Andrei Milanichev. Really, yeah. Not out of nowhere for longer time powerlifting fans, but for people looking at the current state of powerlifting, definitely an out of nowhere performance by Vlad Alhazov, who became the first 500 kilo squatter back in July, and in late July he squatted 500 kilos for the new world record, you know, crushing the current world record. Doing it in a way that I don't think anyone really looked at and thought, oh, that was high or anything like yeah. that. He did it to a high standard, to a good standard. And then 2 months after that, someone that barely anyone had ever heard of, you know, Vlad Alhazov had been a multiply lifter previously and had the world record for multiply in the squat, and I think had done, you know, well in like 1250, something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
And had then blown out his knees and had to have like a knee replacement after getting injured doing attempting a 1300 pound, almost 600 kilo squat. And you know, as we do on this show, when he squatted the 1250, it was to good depth. It was not. If everyone was doing multiply lifts that looked like Vlad's 1250 squat, at least from myself, there wouldn't be near the distaste for multiply lifting because he did it to a high standard, a good standard. So yeah. An incredibly, incredibly strong guy. I won't get too much into this, but there's a lot of people who say Westside Vlad Alhazov when he was multiply lifting, or that he still does this stuff. He trained at Westside for like a week before the WPO. All right. He was not from Westside, but that's a discussion for a different day. So 10 years ago, he squats 1250 in multiply, blows his knee out, later with a later attempt, is kind of gone from the powerlifting scene, minus a couple training videos last year, yeah. And then boom, 500 kilo raw squat, first person ever in history. And as it so often does with these monumental feats of athletic performance across all these different sports, when there's this seemingly unbreakable barrier, and then someone wills themselves physically, mentally to break that barrier, it becomes simpler for others to break it. And shortly after Vlad Alhazov did it, Mojtaba Maleki from Iran, who was a former IPF lifter, comes along and does it as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, but besides like real IPF single ply fans and probably some people in Iran, no one, even you're not casual, you know, you're very involved with powerlifting fans, I don't think had heard of Mojtaba Maleki before he did 500 kilos.
It's pretty amazing, because neither one of those guys would have been on anyone's radar going into that, you know? Especially Vlad. Vlad had been basically gone for, I mean, I think people assumed he was just done.
Yeah.
And to have him come out and do a raw meet, you know, with wraps and do that was amazing. And then the Iranian as well. I mean, he was probably even more off the radar in terms of like just he was just not a contender for it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, he was a very good IPF lifter, not the best one. And yeah, I don't think anyone, you know, 90%+ of people would have said Milanchev was going to be the first to do it. Some people would have said Zahir. Maybe some people would have said Eric Lillibridge. But for Vlad to come and do it, and then Maleki to come and do it, was remarkable. I think it's a huge testament to just the Vlad, particularly coming back from that kind of injury, the mental fortitude to do that, the bravery, really. I've put 992 pounds on my back and tried to squat it. And people will ask, you know, what's that feel like? And to a large extent, it feels like the way that your PR feels like to you. I think, you know, I can't say that for sure, but it doesn't, I don't feel like it's smashing me that much extra. But as my, you know, powerlifting career kind of went on, that first time of doing 800 is a different feeling than doing 790. And the first time of doing 900 was a much different feeling than having done 865 before it. And you just kind of have those limitations or that sort of threshold in your mind where you get to different weights on the bar and you start to think about it a lot more. You start to think about, you know, the consequences of what could happen. And to put those kind of feelings aside, for anyone, someone who had no injuries throughout his career to go and do 500 kilos would be phenomenal, and to sort of break down that barrier. But for someone who had such a serious injury as he had, was pretty incredible.
Yeah. It's amazing that to come back from an injury and do that, you know, that's very commendable.
Yeah. And so now the question becomes, is when will someone do 500 kilos in sleeves? And
yeah,
you know, there are two guys for sure knocking on the door there. I mean, I think the overwhelming favorite to be the first person to do it, and I believe he's talked about this himself, is Ray Williams.
Yeah.
His progress continues to be incredible. His total's amazing. Yeah, he just has had such a rapid rate of improvement that could certainly be in the cards this year. Maybe in June in Calgary at IPF Worlds, Ray Williams puts 500 kilos on the bar, because he might have to do that to have the biggest squat there, because Jezza from Nauru, I know he took a great shot at like 480 or 490 a week or two ago at a meet in like Oceania Powerlifting Championship kind of thing out there. His front squat at over 400, over 900 pounds, 410 kilos.
That's so, just insane.
Yeah, both of those guys, they're gonna now take that next step in the evolution of strength and of powerlifting. It was amazing when it got done in multiply and then in single ply and then in wraps, and now it'll be done in sleeves and shit. Maybe at some point some guy's going to squat 500 kilos with no sleeves and no belt. But so incredible. You know, congratulations to Vlad. Congratulations to Malecki. You know, future congratulations to when Milanichev and Zahir and maybe Eric do that as well. But I think now the hunt is on for 500 kilos in sleeves, and everyone's going to be watching closely in June at IPF World Championships for Ray and maybe Jezza as well to take some shots at that in just a pair of sleeves. So that segues right into our next story, our fourth story, which are kind of these scandal and changes in the USAPL and the IPF. If you listen to our episode, Injustice in the USAPL, of these issues of specifically Keith McHoney, but a couple other athletes that came to light after the fact, Dave Richardson, I want to say, is one of the names, was a Masters lifter, being left off or not being invited to compete at 2017 IPF Raw World Championships because of politics, let's say. The USAPL has had other scandal and stuff to follow that, and most of those came in the way of positive drug tests, a shitload of positive drug tests. Which could, and I'm not 100% sure if this is still an ongoing issue, but there was definitely the potential for that to jeopardize the USAPL's standing within the IPF and potentially disqualify part or all of the teams from competition, international competition. I don't think that has happened or is going to happen. And hopefully it was taken into account when making these decisions that basically all of those positive drug tests, in the ones in international competition that affect IPF standing, were caused by juniors, were caused by bench-only people, were caused by masters, were not the open team. You know, the best powerlifters in the world were not the ones trying to do this, not the people who have been, you know, training and competing in the USAPL IPF for, you know, a decade plus, and training for 2, 3, 4 decades for, in some cases, not those most high-profile lifters. It was the, you know, junior lifters trying to come on quick, or you know, just sort of the side, the peripheral periphery of things with the bench only. So I'm very glad that the open lifters had not been punished for that. Now, some viewers or listeners might think that, oh, you know, they're protecting those more high profile lifters and just scapegoating the other ones. And that's an argument that could be made. You know, if you watched Icarus and you listen to our podcast about Icarus, there is certainly, you know, widespread mass corruption regarding drug testing and everything that entails throughout the world. I would be shocked if that was the case. USADA wants to catch everyone. They love fucking catching people.
Yeah.
And they love announcing it and you know, scoring one for the good guys there. And that's why I see, I guess, secondhand with Marissa what it's like, the Adams list and updating whereabouts and frequency of testing and all that stuff. And if you're doing it in the USAPL and if, you know, and likely in USAW as well, they're gonna catch you because they love catching people. It's their favorite thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a people make that statement like somebody is being protected, this and that. It's just so unlikely that there's any kind of large scale. You know, there's no conspiracy. If there is anything, it's going to be a small group of people, you know, doing their own thing. Maybe there's 5 or 6 or a club or a couple of clubs that are, you know, like facilitating something, But it's definitely, you know, it's definitely just an isolated incident or pockets of that. There's never going to be a wide scale, you know, doping conspiracy here.
Yeah, there was an article recently about that because of Russia being sanctioned now for the Winter Olympics as well. People bringing up like, you know, don't throw stones if you live in a glass house kind of thing, saying, well, America cheats too. They just do it with an American accent rather than a Eastern Bloc accent. So it's kind of easier for people to overlook it. But that is the big difference. You know, the information in Icarus and from Grigory Rodchenkov up to Mikhail Mutko and Voldemort Putin, Vladimir. this is going to the highest level of the government. You know, I don't think that the Donald is getting on the phone with Phil Andrews and like, you know, Phil, we got to be the best. We got to be the best weightlifters.
Bigger lifts. We need bigger lifts.
Yeah. And it's this far-reaching government conspiracy. But rather, when it's happened in the U.S., and there's been, you know, so many drug tests, so many positives for so many high-profile athletes over the decades of serious drug testing in the U.S., but it is those isolated camps. Yeah. Yeah, whether it was that, you know, Balco, Victor Conti group, yep, and Marion Jones, and everyone who's caught up in that, or others. It is the decision of a few individuals, not a statewide, state run program. And I'm sure some of our listeners from other countries probably think that we're just, you know, American sheep, and that's been the sort of the interesting reaction, with Russia in particular, and all these, I mean, as close to 100% proven things as possible. Like they know what Russia did, but Russia, from a political standpoint, a propaganda standpoint, their fans are trying to you know, perpetuate this idea of conspiracy against Russia by the IWF and the IOC and all of this corruption on that side of the thing. Not to say that there's not corruption in both of those organizations, because there definitely is, but it's like, oh, they're out to get Russia, and, you know, they're letting America do whatever. And it's like, that's just not the case. You know, Russia, the only way I can really see Russia getting out of this stuff and getting allowed back into the Olympics, from a national governing body standpoint, is to say, like, yes, we did this stuff, and now we're going to stop. Because if they just continue saying, no, we never did this stuff, then, and there's no acknowledgement of guilt in that, there's no way that they're really going to be able to, I think, get back into the good standing of the IOC in particular.
So I think that's an interesting point, that if Russia admits to doing it, to get back in, then everyone's left in the place where, how do we trust them? How do you know, if you admit that you're guilty, how can anyone trust you again? The other side of the coin is that if they don't ever admit any guilt, they're able to maintain the victim status of, hey, we were screwed over. It's always everyone else's fault, or, you know, we didn't do this. And they'll never, you know, they don't lose that. We hate them and the IOC hates them. Everybody knows they did it, but you can't prove it. So the idea of, you know, keeping them out of something because we can't, even though we can't prove it, not so we can't prove it, but if they never admit, then they never give up that control. They never give up that position. It's an interesting scenario, right? It's like, is it even possible for Russia to be part of sports? You know?
Yeah. And we'll get kind of maybe a bit more into that in our 2018 predictions, but that is, I think, the real question being begged. Cause if you never say, I was wrong, I'm sorry, you know, I don't see how it can ever move on from that. If there's no acknowledgement that, yes, we were doing it wrong and now we want to fix it. If it just keeps saying, no, we never did anything wrong, or everyone is doing it wrong, they're just only picking on us about it.
Yeah.
So along with, you know, there's numerous positives within the USAPL and the selection procedure stuff that we talked about before, there was also a massive issue towards the end of the year in the IPF, and that was regarding Powerlifting Australia and the Oceanic Powerlifting Federation, both run by Robert Wilkes. And Robert Wilkes, that is the namesake of the Wilkes formula. You know, so the probably the most popular kind of body weight coefficient stuff that goes on in powerlifting. He created that and was the president CEO of Powerlifting Australia, which is the Australian IPF affiliate. And in October, the IPF executive committee had voted overwhelmingly, I want to say 49-1, to remove Powerlifting Australia at, you know, to remove their status as an IPF affiliate. And in doing so, you know, maybe set a precedent that whistleblowing on the IPF or complaining about the IPF through the formal channels that are designed to do so will not be tolerated. As with the IOC and the IWF and all this stuff with Russia that we kind of went on a tangent there about, the IPF is certainly not beyond reproach. And I'm sure have plenty of skeletons in their own closet. And Robert Wilkes, I think, aimed to expose some of those. And I, having been around the Australian powerlifting scene quite a bit, the untested side of things there with the GPC, it doesn't sound like he is devoid of skeletons in his own closet. But he went through the formal processes of making these complaints on numerous occasions about the IPF, and the IPF said, enough of you, you're out. And in doing that, in removing PA and in removing the status of the Oceania Powerlifting Federation, there's a lot of uncertainty right now for what it means for people like Liz Craven, for John Paul Cauchy, like a lot of really good Australian lifters who are very competitive in the IPF don't have a path to world championships at this point, and don't have, you know, they can compete in the PA, and but at that point, at this point, that's really just another federation there in Australia. So, you know, I don't know what is going to become of it. I do think that, and I've heard that there's, you know, a new federation being created. I think if that's true, assuming that is true, and it being run by the person I believe it to be run by, that's something that was being put in place before, maybe long before the ousting of Robert Wilkes and Powerlifting Australia from the IPF. And you know, that the people who run the IPF are not dumb, and they're not about losing money, and they're not about losing, you know, at least in the raw powerlifting side of things, the country that was maybe third or fourth biggest entity in the raw powerlifting in the IPF, which was Australia. They're not about losing all the revenue that comes from that. So in doing so, I'm sure that they already had a plan in place before, you know, booting him out by, I think, a 49-1 vote was one of them, and a 48-2 on one of the other counts. But it's tough when politics, you know, not geopolitical politics, but the politics of sport ruin it, you know, interfere with a sport that's so straightforward as powerlifting and weightlifting, or sports that are so straightforward as powerlifting and weightlifting, of who lifted the most weight, and all this other shit has to muddy the water. And you know, hopefully a resolution for the Australian athletes who would be headed to Worlds can come about before June's World Championships in Calgary, so that Liz Craven can be there competing, you know, in a competition she's earned her way to. I don't have the answers, really any of the answers regarding you know, all the back room dealings that may have come about to create the situation, or what the future really holds for it. But yeah, just a tough spot for the lifters, because it became about not the lifters. It became about the money and the executive people in it. So hopefully for the lifters' sake, there can be a timely resolution, and the people who earn their way to Worlds get to go to Worlds.
Yeah. That's one of those things where it's just like, it's unfortunate that there's an irony to me in the aspect of all these things, the sport, especially powerlifting and weightlifting, where it's such an objectively simple sport and such an objectively simple, there's nothing very complex about it, yet somehow politics continue to find their way into every aspect of it, right? And it's sort of an unfortunate, this is unfortunate that happens. I guess when the sport is that simple, it maybe becomes boring, and then people's minds start to shift to other things, I guess.
Yeah. So yeah, good luck, Australian lifters. I mean, I have a girl that I coach who would be the 63 kilo representative at Worlds. So yeah, I hope for her sake and mine as a coach, I get to get that they can get those things sorted out. Even though I still am 95% sure that it was Robert Wilkes who complained about my footwear in the back room at Worlds, I don't know if that was taken into account when ousting him.
Actually,
but it may have
brings
been.
Us to our fifth on the list, Chad's footwear.
Yeah. So we are going to take a quick break and hear from another one of our sponsors, and then we'll be back with our last story in our top five strength stories of 2017. Thank you. So buying tickets to sports and concerts can be complicated, but there is a better, simpler way to buy with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to live events. With SeatGeek's seamless mobile experience, you can buy and sell tickets in just two taps. Two. And SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There's nothing quite like seeing your favorite team or musician in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. I have it on my phone. It's the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. You can be anywhere in just a few taps, instantly find the seats. SeatGeek actually helped us find tickets to the Ireland versus Fiji rugby game when we were over there. SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever, saving you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. Give you the most bang for your buck because every ticket is graded based upon their value, so you can find the best seat to fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports to concerts, comedy, and theater. Best of all, Jug Life listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code JUGLIFE today. That's promo code JUGLIFE for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. And with Christmas right around the corner, could be a good Christmas gift. All right, we are back on the Jug Life podcast with our top five strength stories of 2017. And this last story was another thing that we pretty successfully predicted in our 2016 episode, so congratulations to us. And that is about the changing structure and the changing landscape of weightlifting in regards to its inclusion in the IOC and the Olympic program. And in the last couple of weeks, we've gotten more information, not necessarily complete information about some of those changes. But in late 2016, Max and I had brought up the issue of maybe weightlifting isn't going to be around anymore. Maybe it's not going to be in the Olympics going forward if they can't curtail this problem. And in our episode, The Future of Weightlifting, which I know many people were hoping was about laser cleans and hologram snatches, we further discussed some changes that were brought up at that point in terms of a number of athletes and team structure. And as of the last few weeks, we've gotten positive news that weightlifting has done a satisfactory job in the eyes of the IOC in beginning to combat the doping problems, and they're going to get to be around for 2024 and 2028 Olympics. you know, I think pending that they continue to do a good job with those things. We also know that there has been a change in qualifying procedures for the Olympics. So we knew back in you know, March or April or whenever there was the last bit of information to come out that the number of athletes was being reduced, that a full team for men had gone from 6 to 4, and that for women it would be staying at 4. And, you know, and that is both an effort towards gender equality and an effort and a punishment to weightlifting to not have as many athletes. But in the last, you know, few weeks and month or so, we've learned that the way that qualifying will happen is not as a country. It will not be, you know, the U.S. and China and so on and so forth earning team points at world championships and being designated a certain number of spots which they can fill with kind of any athletes of their choosing, but rather the athletes are going to be qualifying on essentially an individual basis. It will all be about, you know, projected placing. It's athletes that are like the top 14, I think, athletes will be able to go, and only four athletes per country per gender, and only one per weight class. So, you know, some of those weight classes like China, or like some of those weight classes where a country like China may be particularly competitive, like 69 kilo men or you know, 58 kilo women, those sort of classes, where they probably have 5 people who could go and contend for medals. They'll only be able to send one. So on just within each individual country, it's going to create greater competition within the weight classes. It's, I'd think, an advantageous thing for the U.S. as we were the bottom, no, the second to bottom tier for women, because we had 3 spots. And then for the men, we were relegated to only an at-large spot for the last Olympics. So I think it's much more likely that on the women's side, we have a full team of 4 women, I would predict, in 2020. And the men, you know, 3 or 4 men going to the Olympics for weightlifting, I think is a pretty likely scenario. Now, some of the new information that's come about that's a bit more cloudy and a bit more open to speculation is this idea that came out in the last couple of weeks that there is going to be 10 weight classes for the World Championships beginning in 2018, but there will only be 7 weight classes at the 2020 Olympics. The rationale behind this, I'm not entirely sure. And the way that the weight classes are going to be selected, I'm even less sure of. And there's not many people there's no one that we really could have talked to who could have given us much insight on that, because we talked to the people who would have been able to, and they either didn't know or wouldn't tell us. So there's going to be a restructuring of the weight classes, which is definitely a necessary thing to erase the records, you know, an attempt to erase the history of the doping and all that stuff. But what those new weight classes will be, we have no idea. And what 7 of those 10, or if 7 different weight classes, or how it's going to be going to the Olympics is all up in the air. So Max, as someone trying to coach athletes to this, like how do you kind of inform the athletes about, like, this is how much you're going to weigh or anything like that?
Yeah. I mean, it's so weird because apparently we've heard that we won't know that until the end of 2018 as to what the weight classes will be.
I think like July 2018 is sort of the meeting.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Which is bizarre. I mean, 10 weight classes, if you imagine adding another 2 classes to men and women, it just doesn't make sense where it would go. I mean, the you know, not to sound mean to any of the competitors in the 90 kilo class, but that class is empty. It's devoid of any, you know, I mean, it's just not a competitive class by any standard. And to dilute that even further in the women, if you had a 90 and then 100 and then 110 or something, you're going to have, you know, you're going to end up with people qualifying that are just not capable, not of the standard to lift at the Olympics, being there, or even at the Worlds, or at the Worlds, sorry. You know, these people would just be, it'd be nothing to qualify because those classes are so easy because they're so shallow already.
Yeah, right now.
And to put it in the middle makes no sense because then you have all these people grouped so tightly together. It's really a challenge. I mean, I don't really understand where they're going to get 10 classes from.
Yeah, because right now there's a 42-kilo spread on the women's side divided between 8 weight classes. So going from 48 to 90-plus, you know, 42-kilo difference between those. So if we were to think that with 10 weight classes, maybe there's going to be a 50-kilo spread, my guess is that the smallest weight class becomes a little bit smaller.
Yeah.
You know, that maybe 48s turns into 46s, but now it's like, you know, what senior athletes can actually fit into that? And then that there's my hope in it, you know, kind of agreeing with Max, is that the smaller weight classes and the middle weight classes are much more competitive and much more impressive in a lot of ways. And if you're into sort of a no woman's land, you know, in this 85 to 110 ish, you know, with the exception of Tatiana Kasharina, this 110 to 15 kilo range where there's just not as competitive of lifting on the female side. You know, you've got the 90 plus girls who are just like on the men's side, they're 90 very plus. You know, they're much heavier than 90 kilos, the ones who are winning the medals there. Just like on the men's side, they're way above 105, the guys who are really competing for the medals. They're 150, 160, 170. So to add another class up there is definitely going to dilute the competition. But, you know, if it ends up going 46, 50, 54, 59, you know, 65 or 66, it is... There's going to be a lot of good lifters there, but then there's no good way that I can think of, and hopefully someone at the people at the IWF are more clever than I am when doing this. There's no good way that you can go from 10 to 7. That do you
no,
just pick,
I mean, what, yeah.
Yeah, do you just pick the 7 most competitive?
If they have a class and they're like the 90s and it's removed for the Olympics, who is going to chase that class down in the years that aren't Olympic years?
Yeah.
I mean, what's the point? I guess I could see this though. I can think of a scenario. It just came to me where they have, let's say they change the classes enough that they're still relatively close together. So you could have a situation where, let's say you have a 50, a 54, and a 58 class or something to that level, or some classes that are close, where in the off years when you're at the Worlds, you're competing in a class above your normal class or your regular class. Then for the Olympics, you would have to move to one of the other classes the last couple of years going into the Olympics to allow yourself a chance to qualify for the Olympics for that class, right? And in doing that, you open up the other classes that are not necessarily as competitive. So you can imagine there's like a shift. So if you have 10 classes that drops to 7, the last 2 years scoring points into the Worlds, people start to adjust themselves towards those classes to be competitive because they're going to have compete in that class at the Olympics.
But do we even know I mean, we're going to have the 10 classes at 2018 Worlds, but are the,
oh, would we even
are
know
the people
what they
gonna
were
know
at the
which
Olympics,
seven
so, huh?
of the 10 are actually going to the Olympics. And I,
that just adds a level of politics that's just absurd.
Yeah. I think what we do know is that they want to punish guys who weigh about 94 kilos.
Yeah.
Because there was so, know, there was a ton of positive drug tests everywhere, but particularly that weight class had even more. So that's been made fairly clear to us by people more in the know, that the 94 kilo-ish group, whatever the weight class gets restructured to, those guys aren't going to, that weight class is not going to be included. It also sounds like that the 90 kilo class for women is not going to be one that gets included towards the Olympics. You know, don't quote me on either of those. These are not hard, you know, this is not from the IWF, but from the people we've talked to, it seems like that's going to be the case. That makes sense with the 90 kilo women. They're brand new, so it's the easiest one. It's the easiest one to take out. The 94 kilo thing for men, that sounded about as definite as any of the information that we've been able to hear so far, is like those guys aren't gonna be chosen for the next Olympics. You know, the people in that class can obviously go up in weight, go down in weight, and try and qualify there. I would think it's also, you know, the smallest weight class, the 56s for guys, maybe is in a bit of jeopardy as well. But a lot of it's just speculation at this point. It's going to be tough for them to have a good resolution in this. And with the idea that it's individually based qualifying, I can't see them having these 10 weight classes at the world level and then having 7 different weight classes. I think they'll pretty much have to select 7 of those 10 classes. Otherwise, the new qualification system seems like it would be obsolete. Like they just went to the trouble of creating it and now it's not really going to be pertinent. And then I think the other thing that the IWF or the IOC need to sort out in terms of Olympic qualifying and something that could, if they don't take a bit of a harder stance on it going forward in 2018 through 2020 and so on and so forth, is the idea of transgender athletes. And, you know, we have a whole podcast that talks about this and it became kind of a hot topic again with Laurel Hubbard taking second to Sarah Robles at World Championships. But if what Laurel Hubbard is doing, which is and as I had to do 20 times in that episode, you know, forgive me if I'm using the wrong terms here, but she has not had a gender reassignment surgery. There's only been hormone therapy. So I feel like she's meeting the lowest possible standard of transgender stuff, and her emotions and feelings about the issue aside, you know, this stuff can't be based on emotions and feelings because those aren't quantifiable. But if people in Laurel Hubbard's same situation are allowed to make this transition, make the transition of competing as a man to not even getting the surgery and stuff and then compete as a woman, that's such a relatively low barrier. And it's going to become more, you know, it's just going to happen more and more frequently. And then it's all the female lifting records at some point with that are going to end up being held by people who used to be men, you know, like that's what's going to happen.
That's just a totally, I don't think there's going to be like a flood of men that have no interest in being a woman just doing it for the sake of competition. But there are more than enough talented transgender athletes that are in the same boat as Laurel Hubbard, I'm sure, that could potentially start lifting in that against women that are not transgender.
Yeah.
And, you know, then you have a totally muddy scenario.
I wouldn't put it past, though, like a North Korea to just take the whole men's B team. And you're like, well, our women's team just got, you know, the budget for razors went way up, but they became much more competitive. So that's something that needs to be figured out in this new structure of weightlifting. And then the last piece of that is with some new news or interviews coming out, and it's purely speculative, but they've done a good job taking a harder line on doping, and then you see an article about Ilya Ilyin potentially coming back to lift in 7 months. Whether it's these working of legal loopholes that, like, if because he tested positive twice, but because they were both retroactive, the second test he wasn't aware of, he hadn't been notified of the first test positive when the second test positive occurred because they were both retroactive, that they're not treating it the same as a second doping violation. It's rather like they're treating it like two first times because he didn't know about the first time when the second time. And that sounded to me, or seemed to me, like the workaround or loophole that they were fitting this into. But if they're going to let athletes come back from two positive drug tests, whether they knew about the first one at the time of the second or not, it's like a double jeopardy, kind of some sort of double jeopardy thing. But if they're going to start letting athletes back, as incredible as Ilya is to watch, and as much as I think Max and I would both love to see him clean and jerk, 250, if you're going to let guys like that back who have two positive tests, everything they've done for the last year to be allowed to stay in the Olympics is just going out the window. Like,
it's just absurd. There was, Ali Husseini had two doping violations. The first was 2 years. The second was a lifetime suspension. And then the rules changed and went from your second offense being lifetime to your second offense being 8 years. So the guy kind of compete the worlds, which is fine. I mean, if they change the rules and he served his time, whatever. But to be in a situation where,
when he got the first one, like 16? Yeah.
It just shows like such a limp attempt at, it'd be really easy to make doping bans lifetime first offense. There's so much evidence actually to support that kind of choice anyways. One is that a more strict penalty is going to be, you're going to lose your team if everyone's failing tests. You're just going to, through attrition, you're going to lose lifters. The other is that there's very, very strong evidence to show that taking anabolic steroids has a very long-lasting permanent effect on your physiology. And even using them for, a certain period of time and getting caught, the effects are not necessarily the same afterward. Your body responds differently afterwards. So you have these permanent advantages so that it's still not fair, especially on the female side. Yeah, so I think it's one of these things where...
And for the out-of-competition testing for athletes under the sanction.
Yeah.
A lot of these athletes who are just getting caught at the Olympics or at Worlds, and it'll be interesting to see in the weeks and months to come what sort of positive tests come out of IWF Worlds here in that we're just here in Anaheim, because it's USADA running the testing and yeah, that's they're just playing by much more strict rules than the Kazakh WADA affiliate lab kind of thing. So these athletes are getting popped. They're getting popped because they're getting real testing for one time a year or one time every 2 or 4 years. But then they go back to their country and are under the sanction. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that they stop training. And if WADA couldn't get to them for out of competition testing while they were competing, it seems much less likely that they're going to be able to get to them while they're sanctioned. So Ali Husseini, gone for 8 or 10 years, but what was he doing during those 8 or 10 years?
Yeah. It's one of those things where I feel like they have the rules. They actually have these rules in place. There's the association rule. So anyone who's training in a club or around a club or is part of the sport, on any level who has a violation makes other people in that involved with that person subject to sanction. and that rule could be enforced very heavily. You know, the same thing with, you know, changing the length of the ban to represent, you know, the severity of the crime. Instead of handing out 7 month or 2 year sanctions for anabolics, you know, hand out maximum sentences for them right off the bat.
Yeah. And I think that's one where, sorry about all the sniffling and coughing today. Both Max and I are kind of sick, but, one where the US and USAW and maybe USADA are a bit soft in some of these situations, especially the association rule, where they're letting people slide on that, or they're giving, you know, I don't know if it's a plea deal kind of thing or what, but for the country that, you know, wants to be the toughest on doping, they're not being the toughest on doping or as tough as they could be.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of cases. I mean, there was that, you know, people getting 2 year suspensions for performance enhancing drugs. You know, I mean, there's definitely different classes. Obviously, if you fail for a stimulant, the suspension is usually about 6 months, which I think is at least fair in the sense that, you know, you just assume anyone who has banned substances in their body, you know, probably got them from somewhere. It's or put them in there themselves. It's you know, there is the tainted supplement stuff. There is that. But the means to avoid those tainted supplements does exist. There are lists of supplements that are approved. And if you stick to the list, you have no concerns. You know, going outside of that and doing things slightly on the fringe of what you know is possibly okay, that's your own call. And that's, you know, if you get popped, you get popped, right? If you make a mistake, you make a mistake. But there are approved supplement lists. So all these things are in place. All this stuff exists. Handing out, you know, sanctions for stimulants, less so than anabolics, is one thing. But handing out shortened sentences for people that are caught with anabolic agents in their body, it's just not – where's the enforcement? You know, where's the incentive to not do that? And then, you know, there's a frustration, I think, in the sense that there's a lot of talk about, you know, doping elsewhere being a systematic thing and this and that. But we're talking about people that are genuinely, legitimately cheating to get ahead and not really suffering the consequence, and what message that sends to people where they're like, well, okay, you know, this guy got popped or whatever, and, you know, does the whole cry on camera, and oh, now they're okay. You know, this guy really regrets it, or it was a mistake, or somebody put it in their drink, or what other bullshit there is that exists in the world of excuses. But that message gets sent to everybody else saying, hey, it really wasn't that bad for him. You know, they got a 2 year suspension or they got a slap on the wrist. Like, oh, maybe I'll try it. And it almost sends the opposite message, I think.
Yeah. And if I had to make a 2018 prediction regarding that stuff, I wouldn't be surprised if there was bigger, bigger doping suspensions and scandal coming down the pipe for U.S. weightlifting for some groups groups there. And hopefully, I think, you know, tougher sentencing and tougher enforcement of things like the association rule by USAW, tougher penalties in some of these cases that just have outlandish, you know, people, outlandish reasoning behind them. So
yeah, when you've got six guys on your team that have all failed a drug test, like, at what point does it become like just a joke? You know, I mean, you've got, I remember Bulgaria was probably the best example of this. They had 11 members of the team in 2008. The whole thing failed the test for Dianabol. And then again, 2011, they all get popped for Winstrol, and somehow they kind of weasel their way out of these things. And it's just like, you know, at some point, you know,
the second one, they actually got they used the tainted supplements excuse on a wide scale. And I remember hearing that and thinking, like, well, if they're actually going to let them off with this, and I'm sure there was bribes and whatever else along the way to help. But why wouldn't a country, you know, any country out there,
oh, yeah,
just talk to a supplement company and be like, all right, make this batch, set it aside, crush up these D-ball tablets and put them in there. So when we all pop, we say, well, we bought supplements from these people and we'll just pay, you know, like it's not that expensive to make supplements. I've done it. Like it's,
yeah.
And you know, that they could create a shell company for that just for the purpose of saying, well, we took these tainted supplements, and then they could change change the label and the name of the company and do it again.
Well, what's to say that an individual doesn't just take their bottle of pre-workout and crush up or dump whatever drug they're taking currently into it and just leave it in there. And then when they get popped, they say, oh, must have been in this. And then when they bring it to the lab for analysis, it turns up positive, and they say, see, they'll get, you know, they can then, I'm not saying you're going to get off scot-free without a sanction, but you got to reduce it. You got to reduce your sanction from something longer to something shorter. You look like you're innocent, blah, 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 blah. Right.
Yeah.
It's a strange thing. You know, if it was lifetime ban, first offense, regardless of how it got there, it's not supposed to be there. I think it's pretty easy to avoid getting ostrine into your body accidentally, or for, you know, any anabolics for that matter. But it's very much a, you know, it's like, if it's easy enough to not get in your body, then there shouldn't be a problem with lifetime suspensions.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that's our kind of our top five stories. I know some of them were a bit more than one thing, but, 2017, a lot of cool stuff happened. A lot of people lifted some really heavy weights, yep. a lot of shady stuff happened. And, I'm sure, you know, in 2018 and beyond, both things will occur once again. So this was the Jug Life podcast. We always appreciate it if you go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review, write us something funny or nice, and maybe we'll read it on the air, like Spooky the Scary, which I don't like scary movies, so I'm a bit concerned already. But it says CWS plus MA equals 5 stars. Chad Wesley Smith knows his lifting, but I'd like to note that he could also have a very successful modeling career. For this reason, I rarely listen to the podcast and usually watch it on YouTube. I've learned a great deal from him. Some of my favorite topics have included fatigue management, the benefits of submaximal training, and the principle of overload. And it says, as a powerlifter, I find Max's contribution to the podcast compelling. As I'm unfamiliar with weightlifting, so Max adds a nice balance to the podcast, bringing a different outlook to the discussions. It says some of his favorite guests so far have been Ben Pollock, Stan Efferding, Dr. Mike, and Ed Cohen. Well, Spooky the Scary, shoot me an email, chad@jtsstrength.com, and maybe we'll get you out a t-shirt or something. We really appreciate those people who go and leave us reviews, and it helps more people find the Jug Life, and so we can share, hopefully, good information with them. You can find the Jug Life on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and at thejuglife.com. Make sure to subscribe to our YouTube so you can see the video versions, my beautiful blue eyes and whatever Max has going on over there. and to check out all the other great content we have, thanks to the world's strongest videographer, Shorty Sedang. If you're interested in coaching for powerlifting, weightlifting, or super total, we have a lot of different offerings for that, which can all be found at juggernautcoaching.com. Max, where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram, max_Ada, or Facebook, or you can email me, max@jtsstrength.com.
And I'm Chad Wesley Smith, @ChadWesleySmith, and @JuggernautTraining on Facebook and Instagram, filling up your newsfeed all day. This was the Jug Life. Happy holidays, happy new year, and I think we'll have one more episode in 2017, but we'll see you next week, and if we don't see you till 2018, happy new year.